Okay, we're back. All right, so just to recap, there was a number of emails that were sent out this morning. One was forwarding Tony Leisowitz's report on the attitudes of Republicans towards climate change issues. And another was a response to a question about the difference between general circulation models, or what are now called global climate models, and energy balance models. And there was a ref. Somebody, you want to just restate what you said about the article in The Economist?
There was a write-up in The Economist this week about different models and looking at the last decade being relatively stable with temperature and the increase in temperature not being the same. And it actually was a pretty good piece because it went ahead and discussed pretty extensively the benefits of both ways of looking at globe. So energy budget.
I actually think the question was referring to that article and still didn't understand the difference. So, and as I was stating before, during my science research career, I used energy balance models quite extensively. And so to the listserv, I attempted to send an email that described those differences in just in a few overarching areas, and then gave some links to some articles I have written in the past about using energy balance models, and an article, and then also for a teacher professional development program a few years ago, I put together a PowerPoint that shows the difference in the resolution and the time stepping size for weather models, global climate models, and energy balance models. It's just a six-slide PowerPoint. So I forwarded all of that on, which Scott hopefully will send on again.
I've got one of them done.
Okay, great.
I'll have one more in a moment.
Okay, so so that's just recapping what happened in the first 10 minutes here. So let's get on to any announcements.
So April 10th, we have the Energy 101 webinar. The Department of Energy is hosting, talking about the course framework that was just released from us, as well as the Association of Public and Land Grant Universities and the Environmental and Education Studies Institute. And so I can send information out again to the listserv about how to sign up for that. It's specifically aimed at higher education.
Okay, great. We did have the NAAAE deadline did get extended again, didn't it?
Yeah, April 5th.
I believe it did. Yeah, April 5th. I was actually on a teleconference call on the 30th and was told it was, I was thinking it was the deadline was the 31st, and I was corrected there. And as we've done in the past, once people get acceptances, we'll put together a comprehensive list of all of the climate-related presentations from the Climate Literacy Network and have it available there for people who are interested in that thread, attending sessions along the lines of climate and energy during the meeting. Any other announcements? Okay. I did want to give an update about the moving forward with the plans for the AGU meeting. We have at least 8 sessions in which we've gotten, we have conveners most of the time. We have 4 conveners, and a couple places we have 3 conveners. For a range of sessions, the session titles are NGSS, the Next Generation Science Standards in K-12, one on higher ed, one on informal education, outreach, social media, and art, one on international climate change education, one on evaluation and research, one on misconceptions and barriers, and one on the effectiveness of partnerships and networks on scaling up impact on climate literacy, and one on beyond climate literacy towards effective responses and informed decisions. And so we will be moving. The deadline for those proposals, which are relatively short, is April 19th. We do have one more session that we're trying to get off the ground, but it could be a high-profile session, but we need to find the right conveners on the role of AGU scientific community in climate change communication. And it's been suggested that potentially this might be attractive to AGU as a union session. But again, I'm trying to identify the people I've asked so far to be conveners have declined, not because they don't think it's a good idea, but mostly because they're overwhelmed with other things that they have to do. So we're working on that. And then the other thing that should be really interesting as this year is that Mark McCaffrey, Minda Berbeco from NCSE, and I have put together a proposal for an AGU workshop. This will be on Thursday of AGU week, and we're hoping that all of the climate literacy sessions will be on Monday through Wednesday, in which it will be basically a half-day large-scale brainstorming session about addressing how to, you know, the different kinds of issues around improving climate literacy across all of these different areas where our individual sessions address particular communities or particular topics. And we've already submitted this workshop proposal to Pranati Asher at AGU. She's the education and outreach lead there. And we will have a room that will hold 60 to 70 people. AGU Education is paying for this, so we're really excited that we'll have this opportunity. The large-scale brainstorming session will be in the morning, and I could pull up, you know what, I'm going to pull up the actual set of questions so that I can let you know what they are. And what we're planning to do is we're going to pose these. There's five questions here. But then at the beginning of the session, we will, with whoever comes, we will refine these into three questions and break out into three breakout groups. And then in the afternoon, those who are interested in staying and synthesizing the outcomes of the morning session would be invited to do that. So the large-scale questions that we would be addressing are, what connections can be made between organizations and institutions that specialize in science, education, communication, and outreach to further overall climate and energy literacy? And the next one is, how can organizations that specialize in climate and energy-related science, education, communication, and outreach and traditionally compete for limited funding support one another through complementary activities to further climate and energy literacy initiatives? And what are the limits of communication and outreach to foster informed decisions, and how can education and pedagogical practices be better applied to create effective information sharing? How can the next generation science standards be leveraged for greater climate literacy? And what are effective strategies for using new media and education technology to increase climate and energy literacy? So hopefully this will be a nice capping overarching session in which anybody who has been involved in the climate literacy sessions would be able to come to. We focused most of the brainstorming in half a day because we kind of realized that most people aren't even going to be able to stay that long. But hopefully we'll get a lot of participation in this session. So that's kind of overall the plans where we are now for AGU. So it's pretty exciting. If we do manage to get that the role of AGU scientific community in communicating climate change, if we can get that to be a union session, we could potentially engage a lot more scientists in the conversation, which has always been one of the goals of working through the AGU, is engaging that scientific community. Sean, are there any questions or other thoughts about that?
Tamara, this is Frank.
Hi, Frank.
One of the interesting parts of this whole communications education split is time. One of the real reasons why education is usually disvalued, or however you want to put it, undervalued, is because it is a long-term effort. If a student in kindergarten now, it takes 20 years of schooling to get a doctoral degree. But that's very true, but this is a long-term issue, so investments in this area yield long-term advantages, but they also yield near-term advantages. So there's got to be a more sophisticated, I'm hearing it in your questions, I'm just wondering if there's any way to add some of the nuance in there about time, because, if we had been doing the work we're doing now in 1990, mm-hmm. Think of the students that are coming out of mm-hmm. that system now. But if we don't invest in it now, think about in 20 years, we won't have it then either. And climate and energy issues are long-term systemic issues. So there's got to be a way of valuing both of these simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what you're wrestling with. And I don't know.
Right.
I don't.
This is Juliet Rooney Varga. Frank, thanks for chiming in about that. I just wanted to add, too, that I think that one of the things people tend to overlook when they think about education and communication and sort of the time issue is that frequently schools function as natural community hubs or anchors. And that I think that there's also sort of a now piece that, with our project, for example, we have these community events once a year, once a semester, where the city councilors come and parents come, and it's just a trusted community place, schools are, and they're sort of, and I think that is something that maybe the scientific community and the community focused on communication sometimes overlooks, that, we're not just talking about educating kindergartners, we're actually talking about educating their parents and their
Exactly.
communities.
Right.
So that's exactly what I was saying was that there's a long-term advantage and there's a near-term advantage that is underlooked. But they mm-hmm. tend to discount us for the long-term, but you can't totally discount it. And you get a near-term, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a more sophisticated, thoughtful approach to this that most people in the communications and media space don't put the time in to appreciate, and I think that's an important piece. Alliance for Climate Education has found exactly that in their analysis, that the kids go home tonight and they talk with their parents, and we know that they are information leaders when it comes to environmental issues in families.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm with you.
Okay, well, I appreciate these comments. I'll see if I can incorporate this into the description, but in any case, we can certainly use that as we frame the questions during the session. Because we've gotten this in actually so early, it's going to be advertised all over AGU through all of their venues. So it'll have quite a high profile, this workshop. Is there any other comments about AGU, the workshop, or the sessions?
Go ahead. Juliet, I'm not sure who's on the call, but and I know that I came in late. I'm sorry for that. But if there's anybody who's on the higher ed or interested in the higher ed group, it'd be great to just hear a yay or a nay, and then we can connect later. Okay. It sounds like it's just me.
Yeah, I think I've introduced everybody by email, so you should have everybody who is interested.
Yep.
Who's expressed interest. And what I will encourage everybody to do, if you go in and look at the different topics that we're covering, even if you're not a convener but you have an idea, you could forward it on to one of the co-conveners for them to include in their discussions. Another avenue for AGU that we're having access to now is we're going to be able to, I'm in the process of just starting to write a brief report for EOS, and so we'll be talking about Clean and what will be the Clean Network, which is now the Climate Literacy Network. And I've mentioned before on the telecon to those of you who are around often that we did have about a month ago probably now a discussion about changing the name of the Climate Literacy Network to the Clean Network. The only reason that has been delayed is because we've been conducting this survey and we didn't want to start confusing people who are less engaged in our teleconferences or in the listserv. The email that went out today gave the link to the list, the survey again. As of last night, we had 93 responses, and we're getting close to closing it. So we are going to close it Thursday afternoon. So if you've already responded, great. And I'm anticipating that everybody who actually calls in probably has responded. So again, great. And if not, please respond to the survey. And then we will have a period of transition for the name so that there'll be less confusion about the difference between Clean and what's now the Climate Literacy Network. Any other comments or thoughts?
Thanks for being so persistent to remind all of us to send the survey stuff in.
Well, we really do want
to
hear.
Things where you go to do it, and then something, your phone rings or your email comes up, and you put it off. Then, so I was one of those people who needed the three reminders, but I did get around.
Great! I appreciate it. Now, I understand that it is very easy to see it and say you're going to do it later, and then just forget about it because everybody's busy. I understand. So I might actually even send one more out on Thursday morning saying we're going to close it at the end of the day. And I'll certainly make a presentation on one of our calls about the outcomes of that. Another thing that I can give people an update about is a month or so, maybe a couple months or so ago now, we talked about potentially having some discussions or presentations on the call about about using social media. And I've had some very interesting conversations with Ellen Klicka at AMS's policy section. And we are probably, it looks now like we're going to potentially have three of our telecons involved in some way with the social media. One will be based on the responses I got from people during that call we had, where we had an extensive conversation about it, that many people on the call didn't really use social media extensively. We'll have one more of a presentation kind of telecon in which we will get some information about how to use it personally, how to use social media to both receive and send out information. Then we will have a panel discussion in which we will hear from various people about how different organizations have the same kinds of goals that we do use social media, and sometimes high-profile individuals. And that will be a panel, and then we will have one around discussion about how Clean, as an organization, as a group, can most effectively use social media. And I don't think these will be back-to-back-to-back, we're getting to the point close to scheduling. It will be before the end of the academic year, which is when we traditionally stop having presentations and take a break from those during the summer. So that is coming also. It's moved kind of more slowly than I had hoped, but we are getting there. Okay. Well, I apologize for the confusion on the email with the phone numbers this morning, and that my email actually went out really late because I have some issues about sending to the listserv from my office today. But I appreciate everybody calling in. If there are no other comments, I'll leave it open to if there's any other comments or announcements anybody wants to make.
Tamara, I have a request of the network.
Yes.
So some of you may know that I'm the lead for the United Nations Framework Convention report that every signatory has to generate every 4 years called the Climate Action Report. In there, there's a chapter on education, training, and public outreach as part of our Article 6 commitments and the UNFCCC. Sorry, that's a lot of gobbledygook. But anyway, we're working on a kind of an expedited round for the sixth version of this report. It started in 2009 and 1990, and every 4 years. But one of the things that it covers the period of time, basically, 2000, the second part of 2009, all the way through now. Those are the period of reporting, action. And, it's very high level. It's national. But a lot of the document is filled up with federal stuff. And there's a narrative section where I talk about all the high level initiatives that are going on in those domains of education, training, and public outreach. And so one of the questions I'm going to send to the network, I just wanted to kind of brief you guys real quickly and see if there's any feedback on how to do this differently, is I'm just going to ask you for, what are the really large scale, high impact or, noteworthy initiatives that are related to this that the network is aware of, so that if we're going to characterize them, there's not just my tracking of this and some of the people that we work with, but something wider field of perspectives. I'm going to ask for that. I'm probably going to give you guys like 5 days. I don't think it needs to sit out there for a ton of time, because probably the group think of is probably going to capture the wide variety of those large initiatives. It's also going to be new organizations that's going to be part of that. So like Climate Nexus and Climate Access both showed up during that period of time. They weren't active before. So, that's the kind of stuff. Does anybody have any questions or any thoughts or comments or concerns?
Well, Frank, I have a suggestion, is that
please,
when you're ready to send that out, you send it out, but then if you let me know a couple days before, I can send out an email that sort of is prepping people for it coming, so that people, and then on the weekly email, I can remind people of it also.
Okay. All right. It's going to be soon.
Just sort of make a multiple. Yeah, okay. That's fine. Soon is fine.
Yeah.
Just give me a day or so before you think it's going to go out, and I can start getting people ready to respond.
Fantastic. Thank you. Others?
This is Roberta. Do you have a link? I was just looking for an old version so I could just see.
Sure, sure.
If you just what we have to go by.
I'll put the link in there. But Roberta, you should be able to find it by the U.S. Climate Action Report, 2010.
Okay.
You should be able to find a link for that. I think it's on the UN website now. It used to be on the State Department. State Department is the official home for this because it's an international document.
Okay, great. That's a lot more specific than what I was searching.
Yeah, yeah. And chapter 9, and as you guys know, the stuff that we work on is always at the end of documents if we're included. So it's easy to find. And lose.
We can just start at the table of contents at the bottom.
We've all been there, so you know what I'm talking about. And I've caught them doing it before. And, it's kind of like, ha ha, not funny. But the other Scott, I'll let you go in a second. The other thing is,
yep,
this is an official U.S. government document. So, one of the things that I'm not clear on, how there's been some interesting articles recently talking about these kinds of things, but one of the things I'm not clear on how to deal with is the funded, I don't know what the right word is, denial initiatives that are going on and confusing people in the United States right now. There's a lot of research going on that corporations and think tanks are intentionally confusing people in the United States. That's having an impact. ClimateGate had an impact. Sandy had an impact. So some of these things that are not in, are on our side of the shop are having an impact. And I don't know how to. I have to figure out a way to do that. They're gonna be comfortable with talking about. But it's a real thing.
Frank, all I was going to say is that, in fact, the Climate Action Report is available on the UN site. So, and your idea of putting in climate or U.S. Climate Action Report on Google, this works just fine. First,
great, thank you.
First item. Yeah, it's there. It is Chapter 9.
So, go ahead.
No, I won't interrupt now. Go ahead.
No, I think you were next. I was just
going to say that it seems like all the emails I sent out earlier today just got went through.
Yeah.
So now you're going to get another announcement of this telecon, along with this conversation about the difference between GCMs and energy balance models, and about what Republicans think about energy and climate change. That was actually quite interesting because it sounds very much that Republican leadership is kind of out of touch with what their Republican community is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the report says that 52% of the Republicans believe climate change is happening.
Right.
So... And it says a large majority, 77%, say that the United States should use more renewable energy resources in the future. Anyway, it's an interesting report.
Right. And then just to throw that another log on that fire, we could get to 80% renewable energy by 2050 if we focused intently, but the United States electricity supply could go up to 80% technically, but that's not the problem. So it's pointing to the same problem, if you get where I'm going.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Just to double back on that point about the intentional efforts to confuse people.
Mm-hmm.
That's a counter issue, but I mean, does anybody have a good report that talks about that? I mean, I've seen stuff by the Union Concerned Scientists. I've seen researchers who've been doing research into this and other organizations. I don't know of any official body like the GAO or anything like that, but I mean, do people feel that that's an important kind of meta thing to talk about?
It's probably useful. I know that Susan Burr's done a lot of work in trying to identify the kinds of issues that come up because of that and how to deal with them.
It seems like you could also make use of some of the Global Warming Six America studies that show how those trends, have gone up and down in terms of, of people's understanding or belief or whatever, and sort of correlate that with the campaigns or Sandy or other things that are going on. Mm-hmm. Because I mean, those reports are very, very enlightening and help paint a broader picture of what's going on.
I see. So use the like Tamara, you mentioned another study, and I've seen those studies where they show like Gallup's answer those questions over years, and you see them go up and down.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then layering in on top of that, some other possible explanations of why these numbers are going up and down. Sandy is one thing, but then there are also intentional, misinformation campaigns is another thing, as is, other initiatives. So the efforts are a lot of efforts going on that have a lot of different modalities, but that's the reality of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I could see it handling it that way. I like that.
This is Scott. I'm curious whether there's a discussion we could be having with AGU. So we're talking about the workshops in the fall, but this starts getting really at the core of certainly what geophysicists are doing, you know, as a profession. And I'm actually quite surprised that geophysicists haven't taken great umbrage with the distortion of their work. Is this a conversation that we really want to encourage them to engage in, or is this really left to us who are doing mostly education?
Well, I mean, my perspective is there are, you know, it's a scale problem. You know, so I was reading some reports today that hundreds of millions of dollars have been poured into the confusion campaign, or however you want to, I mean, I'm not trying to be spurious here, but whatever, whatever, I think you guys know what I'm talking about. And, you know, our funding to counter that, and it's a harder thing to counter than it is to generate confusion, is much less. And you know, much less nimble, and in general, much less money. So, you know, I mean, it's really hard to compete in that space. So I think one study said in 2010, it was like $235 million. So I think part of it is just scale.
I think there's also a couple, this is Juliet again, I think there's also a couple of other factors that make it hard. One is that, you know, basically as a scientist, you really don't have much incentive to engage beyond your group of peers and, you know, academia. And then the other is that it's actually, I would say it's even bigger than the 200 and whatever, 35 million you just quoted, because it's not, the task is much bigger. You're not trying to convince people that status quo is okay. You're trying to actually demonstrate that there's a lot of change coming. And it's almost like every time there's a TV ad that shows a big SUV and says that that's perfectly fine, you know, it's, that's just reinforcing status quo. So, which, you know, status quo is just not tenable. So it's going to end one way or another. So yeah, I don't really know what the answer is, but I think that it is, and is it really the scientist's job to get out there? And are they really, I don't really know that they're the right people, the scientists are necessarily the right people to, you know, there's a few gifted communicators among us, but not many.
I agree. This is Tamara. I agree. I mean, it's been an issue that we've been dealing with for years. I mean, at AGU, the major progress that we've made is that when I originally was having education sessions, it was in the late 1990s, and it was they were union sessions, and then we got a separate section, and which was great. But one of the things that happened, and this occurs at GSA also, is that the scientists don't use, you tend to be talking to just the educators. So finding ways of being able to attract the scientists into a conversation that bridges, that is a shared effort, and actually that is that shared effort is something that I think educators are hunger for, and scientists don't really understand. But in the work that we did with the access data work, where we actually brought together at workshops educators and scientists in small teams, the science, the technical community, the science and technical communities found a lot of value in having that one-on-one conversation. So we have to find mechanisms and ways of making that happen. And even in the ESA Federation, where it's a smaller venue than AGU, it's still been a struggle. And so I think we just need to keep at it. And our visibility at AGU with all of these climate literacy sessions and this year with the addition of the AGU workshop, I think that we're moving in that direction. But I agree with Juliet that, and it's not the job of all scientists to get up there and try to do that communication, but they should be available for those who do have, who can do the communication, to provide the information that's accurate and to clarify what they're talking about, so that the communicators do have the right messages. And that, I think, is what we ask of all scientists, is to be available there.
That's good.
But I agree. I mean, I completely agree, but having the, you know, a very efficient use of some scientists who are going to play that role, because their time is precious, and you know, with NOAA scientists, they want to know, they're willing to do it. They just want to know, this is really going to make a difference, this activity versus that activity. I'm willing to put time into education, outreach, media, whatever, but they really want to have the very strategic, high impact uses of their time. They're going to put 3 hours into something. They really want to, and that's part of, you know, this. But you know, finding those opportunities for those who, you know, and they have this 3 hours 2 weeks from now. You know what I mean?
This is Juliet again. I mean, I guess I'm kind of coming at it from somewhere. I'm sort of a bridge in this world. Like I feel like, yep, on the science side, you're, you know, we just don't get credit for doing most, like this kind of work doesn't count. So
right,
it's like, which is awful, but that's, I can't fit it into my workload implementation plan. So I feel like part of it is like, how do you find ways so that academia recognizes the importance of communicating beyond our peer groups? And I feel like that's something that I need to battle out with my, you know, my administration and my union. And it's a cultural shift that's needed too. But then you say you're talking about high impact, and you know, I think that in some ways I agree. I know that feeling, but I think that there's also this like piece of, unfortunately, the reality of communicating and education is that there's need for hard work, you know, as we all know, like multiplied by a million and then more. And I think that what we need to think about are helping scientists inform tools, you know, like you've got in the Clean Collection and others that are then be, you know, spread and used by many. Because I don't think in most cases, like there have been many, many times when I've heard the expert scientist interviewed by, you know, fill in the, like an NPR or whatever news organization, and they totally blow the communication moment. And that's not high impact. That's actually, that frequently generates more confusion.
Right, right. Well,
yeah.
There's another piece to that, which is, you know, take Richard Alley and
yeah,
what he did with Earth Operator's Manual. That was no small part of his time.
Right.
That was a humongous impact on him. And but I think, you know, it would be interesting to talk to him. But in NOAA, we've had tons of examples where a great communicator working with media, they get dinged by their science leadership for not publishing enough papers. So there's actually a negative, not just a neutral, but a negative.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, believe me, yep. like if I didn't have tenure, I wouldn't be, you know, and am I going to get promoted? I don't know. You know, so I think it's something that it's a structural problem. It's like yet another case of human systems moving slower than the climate system. You know, we're not keeping pace with the need for cross-disciplinary new kind of work. And academic structures just don't have that, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, just a quick camera, I think what was just raised here actually needs to be considered in your questions.
Okay.
This is critical stuff, because I mean there is an institutional cultural pressure against doing this.
Yeah, well, actually, this is something that I want to bring into the higher ed. You know, in my head, biking on the way into work today, I was thinking about what's the higher ed session going to look like if I'm leading it. And I think in my head, a lot of it is going to be what are the barriers and opportunities in our human structural systems, you know, in our social system, in academia, that's preventing us or enabling us to lead on this issue. Because really, higher education should be where a lot of the leadership is happening, right? I mean, it should be a resource. It should enable change. It should be innovative. And yet we're stuck, like, in the Middle Ages in some ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would only say the counterpoint to that, from the stuff I look at, is that you guys are that. It's just the transfer model is not very strong, in my opinion.
Right.
There are tons of new interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary, transdisciplinary programs, certifications, schools. You know,
yeah,
that,
they're coming out.
That there's a ton, and some of it is student generated, some of it's faculty generated, some of it's institutional generated. I mean, it's there. You know, if anything, the stodgiest part is high school.
Uh-huh.
In the system, in my opinion, but
uh-huh.
I you know, that's just a different perspective. I mean, you're on the inside, though.
Yeah, I'm
know,
on the inside.
Yeah, inside the prison.
This is Jason. In a way, though, there was a conversation we had a few months ago with the idea that there's really no federal funding to sustain effective programs or disseminate them beyond the initial research to show they work. And it's
yep.
ironic if you look at, there's a lot of written up about the Finland education system. They've actually taken some of the best practices that U.S. researchers found out and implemented them. Because we research and research and innovate, and we create wonderful things. And then it goes on the shelf and it languishes and it never gets to the next level where it gets wide-scale distribution. There's no structure to do so. And so that's kind of, there's also no infrastructure in place to help high school teachers get access to that, and then the district can't fund it, the state doesn't fund it, the Fed doesn't fund it, so it just disappears.
So, yeah, so maybe that's bringing up, like, in my head, sort of, is there a way that we can leverage technology to make some of these things spread and happen? And then also, you know, I don't know, those of you might have been at the Climate and Energy Literacy Summit that was in California after AGU last year, but that idea of, you know, completely new funding models where, because, yeah, we can't keep on going. The federal government's drying up. It's like not even, it's hard. So where else, there need to be some completely new models, I think, to look at, as you say, sustaining and scaling up.
I would just modify that just a little bit, Juliet. I think the model, even though the downward trend on our funding, I mean, eventually our budgets will come back up.
Mm-hmm.
But always there was a structural flaw in the model before the drying up. I mean, 2009, I think, was a high watermark for climate change education funding at the federal level. But, you know, we all know the money curve is, you know, 3 to 5 years of that grant, you have a 0 to 30% chance of getting the next federal grant or something else. And so the wreckage of those projects is humongous of,
yeah.
you know, the other side of them. And there's no funding to take something that is, you know, proven value and then take it to the next level because there's no next step. Because there's no business model for a lot of this stuff.
Right, right. So incorporating a business model, you know, maybe
yeah,
that's
well,
got to be part
that.
Of the project. Now they've
well,
tried
no,
that. Okay.
They've tried that, and there is no business model.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, because there's not enough money in the system. And so, one of the things that you know, I've been trying to do at NOAA and trying to transfer to other agencies is the transition programs from, you know, research to operations.
Mm-hmm.
In science, we do this. We have we know in science how you have experimental instruments and then you transition them to operational products or something like that. We do it all the time. But in education, we just keep on experimenting. We never really pick out of the experimental pool for a strategic priority what we're going to fund to get to the next level and then fund that. And then if there's another level to, you know, I mean, SACS has the RDQ, research development, deployment, and dispersal. That's the RDQ model. Well, we only do R&D, and there's nobody taking care of the second two Ds after the R&D.
At least not strategically. And you're the best. That's the best I've ever heard that articulated. There are a few places that are doing it, but they're textbook companies. And because of the model under which they work, it's not effective.
Yeah.
The textbooks have almost become, if there's any dissemination in the U.S., the de facto way of doing so.
Yes.
But that the way you made that analogy is the best I've ever heard that articulated. And I think you hit the nail right on the head.
And in fact, just so you guys know, I mean, Clean was one of the candidates for what I could do to take that issue and say Clean has shown itself, the Clean collection the clean process has shown itself to have value. It's solid, and it should be, you know, it should compete for the next round of funding to keep it going. And so that's kind of what we're doing already in the Clean Network, is we're experimenting with this model, because, you know, great things show up, and then if there's not a way to keep it going, it's like, well, why did we start that model so that, you know, Singapore can operationalize it?
Yep.
I mean, I don't have a problem. But, I mean, we should have thought the whole thing through, and that's the part we haven't done.
Trying to get there. I mean, Frank, you've been talking about this, making it happen ever since we wrote the proposal for the Clean Collection. So
yep.
We are moving in that direction, but it's a slow, difficult process, as all of these kinds of changes are.
Yeah.
Yep.
But the problem, Tamara, and I you're right, but is the amount of money on the operational side actually goes up.
Yeah.
You know, if it was you get some efficiencies, but then you get, you know, inefficiencies because the cost of implementation are much larger than piloting.
Well, that's because it's a scale. It's a scale thing.
It's a scale problem. Absolutely. You know, when you got 74.6 million students in the United States, that's a lot of work.
Okay, well, we will. This has been an interesting conversation, and I will try to distill this down and make sure that we incorporate it into this workshop discussion.
All right,
well, thank you very much, everybody, for calling in. We will talk again next week.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye
now. Bye. Bye-bye. Bye.